Welcome to Truth and Liberty. Thank you for joining our daily live call-in broadcast, where trusted leaders bring biblical insights to the issues, and you can call in and get your questions answered in real time. According to the Bible, it's the truth you know that sets you free. So call in today to get answers, information, and resources to help you stand for truth and effect godly change in our nation and the world. And now, here's your host for today's broadcast.
Hello and welcome to the Truth and Liberty broadcast. I'm the guest host today, Janet Porter, and I have a very, very special guest with me today. He was so effective in the halls of Congress as the U.S. Majority Leader that the Washington Post called him the Hammer. He was the guy who led the charge to grow Congress, to take back the majority. He was the one who invented the contract, the strategy for the contract with America. He was the one who led the charge for the impeachment of Bill Clinton. He was the one who called back Congress to save Terri Schiavo and so much more. But I know him as the MVP of the federal heartbeat bill. Yes, the most valued person who led the charge. And I'll tell you how it all started before I just introduce him. There was one day, 2017, we had introduced the federal heartbeat bill, and we were meeting with staffers. We weren't getting through to the members very much, and we were having a hard time getting any traction. And I remember I was on a prayer call with a couple of other people, and this is how the prayer went. Lord, who are we forgetting that could help us? Who is it we're not thinking of that could help us in this effort? And it was like somebody whispered the thought in my mind, Tom DeLay. And I called Tom DeLay. And he said yes. And I am forever grateful because doors swang open. People ran across the street to meet with them. Tommy, we miss you. We need you here running things. The vice president is hugging him, giving him his personal cell. All the things that happened because Tom DeLay was known as the guy to get it done. That's who he is. And we are very, very grateful for his service to the country, his service to life and liberty. And I am very grateful to call you my friend. Welcome, Tom. So glad you're here.
Oh, I'm glad to be with you. You're my hero. I got to tell you, everybody says when Janet Porter calls, you got to take the call. And no matter what she's asking for, you have to say yes. So here I am.
I don't know who says that because I wish that word would spread around. But you actually wrote the forward to my book. You were the guy that made it happen. We ended up with 174 co-sponsors of the federal heartbeat bill, which is more than any other pro-life bill in Congress. You're just a legend, and you were the first person that they used lawfare against because you were so effective. And I remember I told you one time, hey, you know what God told Gideon? Go into the enemy's camp. Just listen in. See what they're saying about you. And because they hated you so much, let me give you just a quote of what Morton Blackwell said. Hey, the only fire under all that smoke is generated by leftist attacks is their burning hatred of a good man. Speaking of you, Rush Limbaugh said, Tom DeLay was despised because he was good. And that really set the stage for where we are right now with a weaponized government and weaponized Department of Justice. But it began with you. So you were the first target. They came after you. What did it cost you? $12 million to finally get exonerated at the end of it all?
Yeah, and my seat in Congress. It was Nancy Pelosi. She wasn't speaker then. Back then when we took the majority in 1994 and started exercising our majority in 1995, the first Republican majority in 60 years. Mm. Newt Gingrich was the speaker, and Dick Armey was the majority leader, and I was the majority whip. And we started implementing the contract with America as we promised the American people. Joe Kennedy, who was serving in the House of Representatives, and Nancy Pelosi announced publicly that they were going to get this corrupt Tom DeLay. So in 1996, I got ethics charges. They dismissed. 1998, more ethics charges dismissed. The year 2000, more ethics charges. In fact, Nancy Pelosi wrote a charge of racketeering. And they said in the charge that I was conspiring to defeat Democrats. I almost pled guilty to it, to be honest with you.
Oh my!
But it was But you see, every election year, they did some sort of ethics charges or that kind of thing, and they were all dismissed. But the media for 6 months would trash me. And then when I was exonerated, they never even put it in their paper that I was exonerated. And then it ended up with a rogue district attorney in Austin, Texas, Ronnie Earle, went through six or eight grand juries before he could get a indictment and charge me with a law that doesn't even exist in Texas. And ultimately, it turned out that I was convicted and sentenced to 3 years in prison.
Wow.
All of that cost $12 million.
How much?
$12 million in legal fees.
Oh my! By the way, they had to go shopping to six or eight.
Luckily, I was able to raise it all from around the country. I raised $12 million to pay lawyers. Yeah.
I was at one of your banquets that were celebrating you. I remember I ran into Phyllis Schlafly at that event. It was in D.C. at one of the grand hotels, and it was packed to capacity. There was support for you, but it's sad that the media is the one and the lawfare that they used. I mean, you've heard it said that they can indict a ham sandwich. Well, they actually had to go to half a dozen, six or eight of these grand juries just to find somebody who'd be willing to go after you, and they did. It's appalling what's happened. And I just believe that God has recompense times seven for you. That's what I'm praying, plus interest. But it's one of the things that is really a testimony of how effective you were. There was one message when we went around from office to office.
Let me just give God glory a little bit, because I was walking with him, holding his hand every step of the way, because I came to walk with Jesus when I came to Congress in 1985, and I've walked with him ever since. And he trained me and girded me, and he protected me through that whole process. They could have really destroyed me as a person, my family, my wife, my daughter, but they didn't, because God gave me the strength to withstand all of that.
You know, let me ask you this. This is an unusual testimony, because most people, they go to Congress and they forget about God. You actually went to Congress and found God. How'd that happen?
Well, it was really interesting. In 1985, when I started serving the people of Texas as a congressman, I was probably the worst jerk, self-centered, egomaniac that you've ever met.
So you were like the rest of them.
Yeah. And I had a senior member, Frank Wolf, from Virginia, who is a wonderful man, try to get in to see me, because he had this little ministry where he was trying to save the families of the members of Congress. The divorce rate in Congress is through the roof. And so he would come to your office and show you a video by James Dobson called "Where's Daddy?" And I didn't want to see him. I didn't want to mess with that kind of stuff. I had been baptized when I was 12, but I didn't walk with the Lord for sure. He took care of me, but I didn't walk with the Lord. And after about 5 weeks, I was embarrassed because he kept calling, wanted to see me and see me on the floor. He said, "I really want to stop by and see you." And finally, I was too embarrassed to say no. And so he came to my office and asked me to watch James Dobson. And Dobson presented a case for fathers that everything bad he said about fathers, I was it. And I broke down. Frank Wolf invited me to Bible study run by Christian Embassy on Wednesdays on the Hill in the Capitol building. And within 5 weeks, man, I was on fire for Jesus. And from that time on, I stood unashamedly for Jesus, and I did for 10 years, I got to live with Jesus, because when you're in the minority, the Democrats were in the majority, they had all the power. We did nothing. Literally, we had no power. We did nothing. So I spent my time walking with Jesus and in the Word and learning. And by the time we won the majority in 1996, I was on fire and trying to lead my members to God and put God back in the public square and doing all kinds of things that the Lord wanted me to do.
Well, one of the things you did is there were the Bible studies, you brought in members, you closed down the rotunda to have a time of prayer in accordance with 2 Chronicles 7:14. Start there. Tell me about that one. That's remarkable.
Yeah. The Lord led me to, my mantra became 2 Chronicles 7:14. When my people who are called by my name humble themselves, pray, seek my face, and turn from their wicked ways, I'll hear from heaven, forgive their sins, and heal their land. And boy, that's where I was directed. And everything I was doing that. And one of the things came to me through the Lord was, you know, that verse applies most importantly to the leaders of the nation. So I got rid of everybody in the rotunda, kicked the press out of the building and closed it up and invited members of the House and the Senate, both Democrat and Republican, and invited the president, George W. Bush. He wanted to come, but he couldn't. And we, for 3 hours, were on our knees. There was no agenda. There was no preacher. There was just members of Congress, senators, and I shouldn't tell you. I don't think I will. You'd be very surprised. Yeah, you can.
When you have people like Hillary Clinton and other Democrat senators and people that you would not think would have any interest in attending a meeting to cry out to God for our nation in distress, I'll tell you what. That's a miracle. That's a miracle in itself to see those people gathered. Barbara Mikulski. It was astounding. And I think that we get caught in the trap of throwing mud at everybody because they're doing such evil. But it may be that God could reach even them. His arm is not too short even to save those that are the farthest away from him, huh?
I can say that. You could say that very, very. I can give you story after story where that is true. And one of them, I will say, that I thought was really interesting. Barbara Mikulski, by going to Christian Embassy Bible studies, was coming to Christ. And she was one of the most liberal members from Maryland, senator from Maryland. She was one of the most liberal members in the Senate. And she came to that prayer service, and it was all us. And some would break out in song, worshiping, and we'd all sing together. And some would break out in prayer. Some would just sit there and watch. But it was astounding, absolutely astounding, of what came out of that rotunda that night.
Well, you actually then had Bible studies. Was it in your office and extended offices? Because I know you brought in people like Chuck Colson and Bill Bright. Tell me about some of that.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure that everybody had Christ available to them, every member. And what I would do is I would invite, we expanded the Bible studies, started expanding like crazy, bipartisan, by the way, every Wednesday afternoon, excuse me. And it started growing. Democrats started coming. We had a wonderful Bible teacher by the name of Tom Barrett, who had this uncanny ability to bring you a lesson that where you were that particular day as a member of Congress, what you were going through personally. And it just he could really touch you. And then I started thinking that we really need to relate what we believe. We are who what we believe, and why we believe it, and the Word of God to what we're doing. So I invited members of Congress and their wives to come to these lectures by some of the greatest men and women of God in the world. They would come and speak to members of, and the best part of that was their staffs were invited to another, the same lecture somewhere else. And we'd have 500, 600 staffers show up for a lecture by Chuck Colson or Bill Bright or Robbie George or Michael Novak. Or, I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Did you feed them? What was the draw? Did you bring food, refreshments? How'd that work?
No, we held a room in the Capitol building, or not one of the office buildings. They would come to that, and that was it, about an hour lecture. If they wanted to stay and ask questions, they could do that. Some of them would come and go, but no, it was members of Congress, their wives, their staffers, in the meeting with Jesus.
Wow. Tell me about the plaque you had that said this could be the day. Tell me about that.
Yeah,
and that's the impact from the police officers.
Yeah. When we were in the majority, I had security, and I got to know and love one of the men that was my security, John Gibson. And I had early on when we were in the minority, it kept coming to me. This could be the day. This could be the day. That's a phrase out of the Word of God. And this is when Jesus will come today, or you may die today. Are you prepared? And so I had it whittled into a little wooden saying that I set on my desk, so that every morning when I walked into my desk, that's what I'd see. And John would, because he was around me, he was like my bodyguard all the time. He would ask me about that. What does that mean? And I got to talk to him about, this could be the day that Jesus comes. It could be the day you die. When he really got down and really talking about it, when he'd take me home or something like that. Well, a week or so later, after we really got into that phrase, a shooter broke into the Capitol and killed the first guard he came to, J.J. Chestnut. And he was running after a tourist who happened to run into the back door of my office. And John Gibson was sitting there. He knew what the shots were that he was hearing. And in comes the tourist and the shooter. And John knew that in front of him were desk after desk of young people that were on my staff. And he knew that if he shot Weston in the back, Weston would have enough gum to shoot those kids. And so he yelled at him, and the shooter turned at him within 3 feet of him. And the two of them shot each other, and John died, and the shooter lived, but was shot. Yeah, that was a tough time.
But because you shared your faith with him, you know what? We got at least a very strong hope that he's in heaven with Jesus, and you made sure that he was honored in the rotunda then too, right?
Oh yeah, we laid both JJ and John in the rotunda. We had a little pushback from especially the Senate that we shouldn't be doing that. That's reserved for presidents. But here are two men that saved the lives of who knows how many. There was probably 20 some odd staffers in my office complex. So John probably saved at least four or five of them. Who knows? And I insisted that they be laid in the rotunda and that they be buried in Arlington as heroes of the nation.
You know, it was very telling, because when we were going around office to office, and we met with well over 200 members of Congress working to get the federal heartbeat bill moving through. It was the leadership of Kevin McCarthy, Paul Ryan that blocked it at that time. But one of the things I noticed before you showed up on the team, Tom, it was like drudging uphill through the snow. It was meeting with staffers. It was trying to catch people. It was standing in long lines around the block to get in the office buildings. And when you showed up, It was like the clouds parted. We're parking at the Capitol Hill Club. We're walking right in offices. We're bypassing the lines. And one thing that was very distinct to me, every police officer knew you and respected you. They more than respected you. They loved you. They hugged you and waved us all right through because of you. And it was just really great to see the respect that you had been denied after all the false accusations and all the things that you had been through, all the horrible headlines, all the press. What I saw in that, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but I saw there was this healing where members are literally running across the street to hug you, saying, "We were just talking about you yesterday. We need you here. We know you know how to get things done." It was so refreshing to see that they got it. They understood what you had meant for America, what you had meant for that body in Congress. And I'll just say there's many people that don't know the things that you have done to serve America. And I remember back in the day when Terri Schiavo's life was on the line, and I was outside her hospice building trying to get her saved. I was lobbying in Tallahassee to try and get her. We drafted a bill on the floor. It was called the Drink of Water Bill, trying to get if she could drink the water, they had to give her the water. We brought in Jesse James, did all these things on the front lines, but you actually called back Congress during the Easter break to save her life. Give us a little bit about that. People don't know what you've done when you were there. I want to get some of that flavor.
Well, somebody was Terry's brother wanted to
Bobby
see
Schindler.
Me. And yeah. And of course I was sort of aware of the case that was going on, but before he came to see me, I had my staff check him out and brief me on what was happening. So we turned all the members loose on a Thursday for the Easter holiday. And I was still there, and I sat down with Bobby, and he was telling me about Terry and what was going on. And I said, "We have got to stop this." And the whole thing was if I remember correctly, you had a district judge that wanted to do the bidding of Terry's husband and pull the plug on her. But the parents said, "No, don't do that. We'll take care of her. We'll take care of her. You don't need to kill her." And so I sat down with my staff on that Friday evening, and the next day, Saturday, I got the speaker, I got the majority leader, the president of the United States. I got them all on board to call for a special session of the Congress. And I called all the members back and we passed a bill. Unfortunately, the only bill that we could get passed, we had some other ideas, but the only bill that we could get passed was to allow the federal courts to look at this case and rule on this case. What most people don't realize is that the Congress can tell the courts what cases they can or cannot hear. It's called limiting jurisdiction. And the Constitution, it's written in the Constitution, Article 3, Section 2. By the way, on the other side too, a decision by the federal courts or any court is only an opinion. The ruling is only an opinion. It's not enforceable, because if you look at Article 3, the courts have no enforcement mechanism. They have to rely on the executive branch to enforce the rulings. And if the executive branch doesn't want to, or Congress passes a bill not adhering to the ruling, we go forward. But this notion that a ruling of the courts is settled law is wrong. It's unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. It's not settled law. Until and when the legislative branch or the executive branch accepts that ruling. And I could go on and on about that. But
well, I know some of the remedies. In the Terri Schiavo case, the judges decided not to do anything, and it was a very, very sad, tragic ending. But you actually wanted to bring in the restraint to the judges, and you actually had a bill that was, I think it's a bill in about the Ninth Circuit that passed took away their funding, right?
Yeah, well, another thing that I wanted to do very strongly is take on the judiciary and the separation of power. Well, from 30,000 feet, I wanted to put God back into the Constitution and the Constitution back into this government, because we are where we are because we shredded the Constitution and kicked God out of the public square. And part of that was the judiciary. I mean, we put up with Roe v. Wade for, what, 50 years and 60 million babies killed just because of a ruling, but nothing said by the government, by the president or the Congress. So
yeah,
I got
seven
with
men
James,
in black robes.
Yeah, I got with James Sensenbrenner, chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and he was of like mind. So we passed. Not into law because the Senate wouldn't pass them, but we passed five bills. Bills like you cannot hear a case on prayer in schools. You cannot hear a case on the Bible being taught in the schools. You cannot hear a case that removes 10 commandments from the school. And the fifth thing was to show them that the Congress is all powerful, is that we said we're going to break up the Ninth Circuit and take and split them up and take their budgets away from them. And if they ever wanted to meet, we couldn't fire them, but if they ever wanted to meet, they could only meet in Guam. And they wouldn't have
You're
a courtroom
awesome.
To meet in. And it passed the House.
That's fantastic. And that was about the time the Supreme Court, out of the blue for the first time in history, came running around saying, we might want to go to lunch. That's when they invited you to lunch, wasn't it? They thought maybe your arm would reach into their chambers.
Right after we passed those reforms, they invited us for the first time in history. The Supreme Court invited the leaders, Democrat and Republican, House and Senate, to lunch with the justices. It's
Tell
a
me
very
about
fun.
What Scalia said, I believe it was. Give me that
yeah,
tidbit.
Justice Kennedy had the week before wrote a ruling using international law, and I just trashed him for writing, how dare him write a ruling using international law for the in the Supreme Court. He followed me around. The first thing is get together, meet and greet. He kept following me, and I'd see him out of the corner of my eye, and I'd move, and he kept following me. He's a big man. Finally, he caught up to when I went to sit down, and he introduced himself to him, and I said, I know who you are. Thank you very much. I sat down at the table. On my right was Scalia. On my left was Senator Leahy, chairman of the Judiciary Committee. Next to him was I can't remember his name now. One of the justices. Next to him was David Obey. Next to him was Sandra Day O'Connor. Next to her was Arlen Specter. And I knew, I'm into it now.
Just half a minute. Cut to the chase.
They've set me up. Tony, who my wife taught his children, so we were good personal friends. He reached
Justice
Tony
Anthony
Scalia.
Kennedy. You called him Tony. Okay.
No. Tony Scalia.
Oh, Scalia.
Scalia reached over and grabbed my arm and says, Tom, what can we do to better our relationships together?
Hold that thought. We're going to come right back and we're going to find out what he said. Hold on. We'll be back.
Okay. You were created with a purpose. Written in the heart of God. Long before you were born, He is calling you to find it. We want to help you experience His unconditional love, to be equipped and empowered to become a world changer.
I'd like to invite you to join me either as an attendee or as a sponsor of our Truth and Liberty Awards Banquet in 24. We started this last year, and this year the winner of our Samuel Adams Award is Pat Bradley with Crisis Aid International. I tell you, he is one amazing person. And then Coach Joe Kennedy gets the Samuel Whitmore Award, and I tell you, that's going to be great. And our guest speaker is Riley Gaines, the lady that has been standing up for you know, getting men out of women's sports. It's going to be a great time. It's May the 3rd. It'll be at our Caris Bible College, and we do have sponsorships. This is a fundraiser as well as an award banquet. So if you would go to our website at truthandliberty.net, you can get all the information and join us on May the 3rd for our Truth and Liberty Awards Banquet.
Welcome back to the Truth and Liberty broadcast. I'm Janet Porter. So happy to be with you tonight with one of my favorite people on the planet. He is the, you know him as the U.S. Majority Leader, Tom DeLay. I know him as the MVP of the federal heartbeat bill. He has done more for this country than probably anybody I can think of, besides maybe President Trump. I'll just say, we talk about a cliffhanger. I want to stop talking because you had us right on the edge, Tom. You're meeting with the Supreme Court. They finally want to pay you, to give you the time of day. They're all in the room. You're meeting with Justice Antonin Scalia, which was my favorite. But you actually called him Tony, and people just, you know, they had to gasp in horror at that familiarity, because we practically worship the judges these days. Give us what happened. Give us a little setup and fill us in.
We worship the judges, and they like that. They like being in that situation. No, we were having lunch, but it wasn't public, but. All the leadership of the House and the Senate, it was having lunch with members of the court. And you're right, Antonin Scalia was sitting at my right. We're chit-chat, and finally it was time. I could feel it, time to do business. So Scalia reached over and grabbed my arm, and he says, "Tom, what can we do to better the relationship between you guys and us?" And I reached into what I always carry, a constitution with me. I said, "Y'all can start reading this." And the table went nuts. Patrick Leahy just, he almost had a heart attack. "How dare you be so familiar with the members of the Senate?" And Arlen Specter, senator from Pennsylvania, "How dare you talk to the Senate, justice like that? Read the Constitution? What do you mean?" I said, "They don't read the Constitution. If they'd read the Constitution, they wouldn't have the rulings they've been doing." Just last week, Kennedy had a ruling that included international law. Totally, he should be impeached for that. so... They didn't appreciate me being there.
By the way, it was your inspiration of restraining the judges using the Article 3, Section 2. It was the idea back in 2015. I called my friend Phyllis Schlafly. I said, "Hey, let's restrain the judges." And I said, "Call your buddy Steve King." And Congressman Steve King introduced Restrain the Judges, saying that judges cannot rule on the issue of marriage, trying to preempt their disastrous ruling in the Obergefell decision in 2015. We didn't get the votes. People don't seem to understand that it's the congressional role to restrain judges. And we had a similar bill in Ohio that we can restrain judges from ruling on this issue one ballot initiative that passed. It's the Congress that can decide what judges are allowed to rule on, right?
And you could go even a step further. I tried to do this with Congressman King, and I'm not sure he agreed to it. Most the best people in the world are taught and brainwashed by their law schools. Even Kim Davis case. Remember Kim Davis,
who was the county clerk that went to jail for not legitimizing licenses of homosexual couples.
They had a big rally for her, and I tried my best to get there. And there were so many people, I could not. The traffic was so bad, I couldn't get there in time to give a speech. And my speech would basically be, "The sheriff is more powerful than the Supreme Court, and that's the Constitution guarantees that sheriffs are the most powerful law enforcement officers in the Supreme Court." He had no right. In fact, if he wanted to be constitutional, he should have protected Kim Davis from being arrested. And he can do that. Sheriffs can do that. We have an organization of sheriffs who are starting to take courses and learning the Constitution because they don't understand what power they have. And Kim Davis today would be free of her problem if the sheriff would have only protected, gathered around her and protected her from the federal law enforcement.
Wow. I want to shift gears because I just was in Washington and I made the rounds on the Hill. And there's a lot of people who are discouraged right now. We're happy that we had a good speaker, Mike Johnson, but I think he felt, at least what they say, is that they all felt forced into passing this multi-trillion-dollar budget. It had homosexuality and abortion in it. It had just crazy things that none of us want, and they claim that none of them want. What would you, if you were there on the Hill, what advice would you give? What could they have done instead, Tom?
Understand your leverage. Shut her down.
Which is the name of the book that you wanted to name it. Your book, Revival, Revolution, and Rebirth. You wanted to name it Shut Her Down. I think you were right. Tell us why you wanted to. Tell us why Shut Her Down resonates. Why is that your course of action you recommend?
Well, what my book is about is to have a third awakening. Like the awakening in the Civil War and the awakening before the Revolution. And once you have that awakening where God is cleaning out his church and bringing his people to himself, then you can move towards revolution. And part of that revolution is you elect a president that will go to this unconstitutional bureaucracy that has been created, that is destroying people's lives and destroying our economy and destroy, I mean, the debt alone will destroy this country if we don't watch out and stop it. And look at the executive branch and see the thousands of offices in the executive branch that are unconstitutional, that the Constitution is there to protect our rights given to us by God. The Constitution is not there to allow, the Constitution is there to not allow the creation of this huge mammoth government.
So you did something about it. I want to get to the part where you actually did shut her down. You actually followed your own advice. Tell us about that.
What happened? Are you referring to my mountaintop experience?
I'm not sure if it's the mountaintop experience, but I know that you were almost on the brink.
Yeah. Right when
that's
we got
when,
the
when Bob
the
Dole came in and opened it back up, that one.
Yeah. When we got the majority, we had to honor our promise of the contract with America. And part of the promise of contract with America was to reduce the size of government and start cutting spending. And in the spending part of our new majority, the first year, 1995, we shut down the government. And it was shut down for over 31 days. And nobody missed it.
The press was terrified. This is terrible, terrible media. It was the barrage. People started getting quaking in their shoes. What happened then?
Well, we were winning. I was cooking steaks for members of the House on a Sunday evening. And they call that, the mafia calls it going to the mattresses when they're at war with each other. So we were at the mattresses and I was cooking for members of Congress. And I looked up and I saw Bob Dole, Senator Dole, walked on the floor of the Senate and opened up the government. And I could not believe it. We found out later, many days later, that Bill Clinton, the next day on Monday, was going to cave in to our demands. Now, I have to say, we gave Clinton a few things to sign our bill, and he did very minor things. Just face-saving stuff, and he signed our bill. But the point is, we got no credit for it. He got all the credit for it. He, to this day, we're the ones that balanced the budget for the first time in forever. And Clinton takes credit for it now. But, During the Clinton years, Clinton never got to sign a bill he initiated after we took over the majority. Our agenda was what we pushed for the next 6 years.
Tell me about your mountaintop experience. I'm not sure. I know this one.
Well, when I was at the end of my career, a wonderful friend of mine by the name of Ames Cartwright, who was a businessman in Oregon, would invite me to come to his gathering of eagles, which he would throw on a statewide political event to bring.
Yeah, I spoke at that event, and you may recall he came and lobbied with us for the federal heartbeat bill before he passed away. Go ahead. I just wanted to honor him in that way. Go ahead.
Oh, he was a wonderful man. And yeah. He would invite me every year, and I would go basically to support him. But it got to the point that I wasn't in power anymore and that it shouldn't be there. And I really didn't want to go, but I went one more year. And I told him I wasn't going to make a speech. I'll be there for support. Well, the first day was Friday. I was on the porch drinking a glass of wine, looking over a valley into the mountains of Oregon, just an incredibly beautiful scene. And here comes a guy named Jerome Corsi. I don't know if you know Jerome Corsi, but he's a prolific writer. He's got a photographic memory. He's read probably every book in the world, and he's like a computer. And we sat there from about 4 p.m. to midnight. And he was plugged into me, and he was feeding me stuff like you wouldn't believe.
Can I just interject something? I just want to interject. I do know Jerome Corsi very well. He came to my wedding. He's the guy that wrote the Swift Boat Veterans that went after John Kerry. He's a brilliant guy. I actually sat him in the front table next to an uncle who was an Obama delegate. So I had Jerome Corsi next to my uncle's. We just watched the fireworks all night. It was a lot of fun. But Jerome Corsi, great man. Go ahead. So he was downloading. And tell us more. Tell us more what happened.
I was plugged into his brain.
Yeah.
And we were talking like that's where Shut Her Down came from. It was for Corsi. He and I were going to write a book. It turned out he couldn't do it. So I did it on my own with a friend of mine, Wallace Henley. But the point was, is I got up the next morning and I was overwhelmed by what I had just experienced. And during my quiet time, about an hour, just walking up and down, looking at the mountain and glorifying God. And God just kept feeding me stuff from this information. I said, I'm going to go make a speech. I didn't have any notes, nothing, just for what I learned the day before. And I gave a speech on Shut Her Down. We have to have God in the country as the core of the Constitution as the core to America, and we've got to shut it down, unconstitutional government.
You know, I'm going to make a plug
I went back to that porch with Jerome Corsi. We sat there till 2 a.m. And when I got up the next day to catch the plane, I was shaking. I was so full of this stuff that whatever was the Holy Spirit was really hitting me really hard. I was literally shaking. I could hardly breathe. I was having a heart attack. So I went, got on the plane, sat down, pulled out my Utmost for His Highest devotional, started reading and praying to the Lord. And for 4 hours, I got to fellowship with the Lord and be with Him and commune with Him on that airplane flight. And when it came time to get off the plane, it was very clear to me that he was going to take me out of the wilderness, the legal problems that I was having, and use me as he wills. And the other was, he made very clear, I'm going to clean out my church, and I'm going to bring my people to myself. And boy, that just flipped me, I tell you.
Wow. Oh, my. That's quite a story. And I want to just say that when I met with you and other members like Louis Gohmert and Congressman Steve King and others, we put together something now moving forward. Back when I ran for Congress last year, if you want to look at the contract that we could implement now, if only members would do it, is the AmericaFirstContract.com, the AmericaFirstContract.com. Tom helped who designed the first contract with America, worked to help fine tune this to make it what it needs to be. And I'd really like to see us get to a place where we're not to the end. You know how this is. It's the same thing every single cycle. Oh no, the government's going to shut down. We've got to pass something. Tomorrow it's the end of the world. And we always see the same, the same reoccurring nightmare where we have more trillions in debt and more trillions going to Ukraine, more trillions going to the agendas that despise our beliefs. I just think that I think we need to go back to the Hill, Tom. I think we need a meeting with you and some of these leadership members to talk about how not to get caught in this trap again.
Yeah, I agree. Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, has a wonderful opportunity right now. It's Democrats control the Senate. Joe Biden's in the White House. He doesn't really know what's going on. And here Mike Johnson, albeit a 2-vote margin, but we only had a 5-vote margin. So, but
we're down to 1 vote now. I think they're down to 1 vote now. That they're worried about Congresswoman Lauren Boebert if she gets sick, and we pray for her health. That they could lose the majority. I mean, they're taking members, Tom, like Ken Buck. You remember we posed with his AK-15 in his office? He got a job, I guess. I think he's the one that got the job at CNN. They're basically trying to get members away from the Hill so that they can turn it. And so we need to pray. There's a lot of fear and trembling on the Hill. We need to pray for those members that they don't jump ship, that we keep the majority. But we got to remember, we need to use the majority. We need to use the power. Seems like Republicans are the only ones who forget why they have power. They think it's to keep power. No, it's to use it. And that leads us to the one regret that you told member after member after member. You said your greatest regret in leaving Congress was what?
I didn't eliminate abortion. I wanted to. I tried to. We did some small restriction bills, and that kind of stuff, and worked with the pro-life community. But it was so fractured. It was difficult to. I mean, you had the National Right to Life opposing a heartbeat bill, and you had all kinds of different people in the pro-life community. No unity, and I just couldn't see how we could ever get to the point of, and I was wrong. I think if we'd have taken it on like you so ably do, and we have to do it now. We have to do it now because the Democrats are going to demagogue abortion in this coming campaign, and the Republicans are running for the hills. Now is the time to stand and fight. And we've got to do that. But I, unfortunately, and I regret it to this day, but thank God for Janet Porter. Allows me to play the game again.
Well, because you're the one leading the charge, because, you know, they didn't really always take my calls. But I'll say this. I was quoting you with members, staff after staff last week, saying Tom DeLay's greatest regret. And they're saying, well, it's the state's issues now, and we've only got a slim majority and the blah, blah, blah. I'm like, you know what? Get rid of all these. The members who came here, they came here with a vision, with a purpose, to make their life count, to make a difference in this country. It's not just to keep the power. It's not just to do as very little as we can, the least controversial. No, it's to make that difference. And I told them all, don't leave this place with the regret that Tom DeLay had. Don't leave knowing you could have made a difference and you didn't. You let all the excuses off the excuse tree win the day, and they don't have to. You know what? I want to go to a graphic in a moment, but there's some people right now that I believe are giving bad advice to President Trump. I pray godly counsel to him every day, and ungodly counsel to be removed, for godly counsel to be put to be there for him. But there are people who are telling him right now that you need a 15-week abortion ban. You remember when we started this, Tom? When I started Heartbeat, they said, that's the ceiling. It's impossible. Can't be done. And here we are, 15 Heartbeat laws later. What was once the ceiling is now the floor. Heartbeat, as I told Governor DeSantis, is the bare minimum that we should pass right now in a post-Roe world. And so what I believe the message needs to get to the president is that, you know, 15 weeks, woefully inadequate. It's a bill that protects almost no one. And let me explain where we are right now in America. Let's go ahead and show that video. There's 20 states right now that have either full protection from conception, 20 states that either protect from conception, from fertilization, or from the point of a heartbeat. All right. So that adds up to, of those 20 states, that adds up to 210 electoral votes. You see those numbers there? Those are the numbers of the electoral votes of the states that have either passed protection from conception or heartbeat bill that protects 9 out of 10 babies. All right. So I wrote a letter to the president, and basically what I told him is, hey, 210 electoral votes. What's the number we need, Tom? 270?
70.
Mm-hmm. You don't want, that's not a battle mm-hmm. you want to pick. That's not the base you want to turn your back on, is it?
Not at all. I'll tell you, that could bring him down. If he goes with the 15 weeks, which I think he has said that he might do that, it is a huge defeat on the effort that you and so many other people have done, and in such a wonderful way. And millions of babies will die because of that. And we may not be able to revisit this issue again for the next 10 to 20 years, because it's so hard. And you know how hard it is to pass these bills.
I do. And I'll tell you that we could we don't stand now. If we don't have the kind of courage that you exhibited on Capitol Hill, we could end up in a world, a post-Roe world, that's worse than living under Roe versus Wade. It's hard to imagine. But right now, it's gone. The restraint that was hanging over us like this dark cloud is gone. We ought to be running like somebody left the gate open. We need courage on the Hill. I mean, I gave so many pep talks. I was hoarse at the end of the day. We need to have the intestinal fortitude to do what we put them there to do. I want to go to the phones. There's some folks who want to get in on this conversation, but I also want to go to a clip you're going to like. 719-619-2341. If you'd like to talk with the majority leader, the guy that the Washington Post said was so effective, we call him the Hammer. 719-619-2341. But when we were walking the halls of Congress, you remember, Tom, while people were running to meet you, where all the members were going, getting their photos with you, there was another constituency. There were teenagers and young staffers, college girls that all wanted their picture with you for a different reason. It's because you were a star on Dancing with the Stars. Let's look at a little promo clip. I think that's kind of fun.
For the first time ever, the Republican Hammer moves to the left.
To dance.
Tom DeLay is Dancing with the Stars, live 3-night premiere Monday, September 21st on ABC.
What was that like? You were winning time after time after time. The votes were coming in. You actually never lost. You just had fractured feet and you kept dancing on broken bones, which, you know, it shows you that wasn't your brightest move, but it sure was a courageous one. Tell us a little bit of what that was like, Dancing with the Stars.
First of all, my partner was a wonderful partner to have. She was very patient. I love to dance, and I love to dance, particularly with my daughter, who actually competed in dancing. So when they called me to do Dancing with Stars, she made me do it. And so I did it, and it was some of the hardest work I've ever been involved in, because you had to practice for like 6 weeks before the first show, every day for 8 hours a day. And what I did wrong, and my partner didn't tell me, is they put you in these Latin shoes with these little heels. Mm-hmm. Well, my entire weight went on my toes, and they popped, and so it was. But I tried my best to get as far as I could get, because I was really enjoying it. I really enjoyed it.
Well, I remember even when you had the injury, the judges were still saying how a phenomenal dancer you were. And they invited you back to do the Texas two-step. I know hopefully that invitation gets issued again, because, you were fantastic. And literally people recognized you on the street when we were walking around D.C. It was kind of a fun, you know, break from all of the heavy lifting with getting the heartbeat bill through. And it was just a neat thing. And, you know, I think we have just this myopic vision of somebody who's that determined, who is that effective, that he can't be fun too and have fun too. So I just think it was just a neat little diversion most people wouldn't have known. 719-619-2341 if you'd like to get in on this conversation with the Hammer, who has trouble going to the left. That might have been what cost you the whole thing, but we're really glad to have you here. I want to make a couple announcements just so people know coming up. Next program, we're going to have Matt Staver on with our regular host, Richard Harris. And then mark down May the 3rd is the Truth and Liberty Awards Banquet. That's coming up, and I'm planning on being there. No, I'm not getting an award. No, I'm not speaking, but I'm going to be there, and I look forward to meeting you there. Karis Bible College Days, that's April 3rd through 5th. Come to the Gospel Truth Way. You know where it is. It's Andrew Womack, Mike and Carrie Pickett, and the whole gang will be there at the Campus College Days. Also, the Summer Family Bible Conference 2024, July 1st through the 5th. I don't know if he's going to have fireworks or not. Knowing Andrew, there'll probably be a fireworks show. But that'll be with Andrew Womack, Billy Eppard, Mike and Carrie Pickett, Greg Moore, and Barry Bennett, Chad Conley. You know, Chad, Faith Wins, and Richard Harris, of course. So it's going to be a great time. Truthandliberty.net is where you can come to find out the latest, watch the programs you may have missed. But I just want to open up again. Those phone lines are open. If you'd like to join, you can dial 719-619-2341. We've got just 2 minutes left, Tom, before we go to the final segment coming up. Anything that's on your mind that we kind of basically missed in this process? Anything that we forgot?
No, we're in the next segment. We need to maybe talk about how you're going to eliminate abortion in America, and how we're going to go from here to this upcoming election cycle. It's going to be tough, and we're going to need a lot of people involved if we're save babies.
Yeah, I want to give the update. I mentioned this yesterday that the Florida court upheld the 15-week ban and the heartbeat bill, which will go into effect on the 1st of May. It's going to save 9 out of 10 babies at a minimum. And as you know, we've talked about this on the Hill, Tom, that as our scientific technology improves, we're going to save them even more, younger and younger, as we can hear that heartbeat earlier and earlier. But we're also, and thanks to Andy Schlafly, a son of renowned Phyllis Schlafly, he is still working on the case. I ask for your prayers for him. We're going to be filing a case in state court in the best venue we can. We're also going to look to file a case coming up in the federal court so that we can take it up to the Supreme Court. I think we can Obergefell them. If they can strike down 28 state rulings, state amendments on marriage, hey, why can't we strike down these unconstitutional rulings of abortion until birth and child mutilation, gender mutilation? It's appalling what's happening, but we're going to stand, and we are not on our watch. We're not giving up. We're going to see, I believe, God work through the courts and work through these elections coming up. So we're here with Tom DeLay, the Hammer, and we can talk with you as well. 719-619-2341. 719-619-2341. If you'd like to join us when we come back, bring your toughest questions. What can we do to get America back on course instead of going over the cliff more slowly? We'll be right back.
At Truth and Liberty Coalition, we work to unify, educate, and mobilize the body of Christ to change nations. That's why I want to encourage you to go to our website at truthandliberty.net and subscribe so that you can begin receiving regular updates about our show, news items, action alerts, blog posts, and much, much more. All you have to do is go to the website, click subscribe, share your email address, and you'll begin to be equipped to stand for truth in the public square.
Hi, my name is Carrie Pickett, and like many of you, I wear lots of hats. But most of all, I'm a child of God. Ever since I was young, my desire has been to share the unconditional love of God. There is nothing more rewarding to me than people changing their lives and then changing the world. That's why I'm inviting you to join me wherever you are, and let's discover together these foundational truths that will transform your life.
Hey, you know, a big part of what we do here at Truth and Liberty is to provide you with the resources that you need in order to stand for truth in the public square. So I want to remind everybody to go to our website and check out our resources page at truthandliberty.net/resources, where you can find material that discusses just about every issue we're facing today in our culture. And these are things that are prepared by our strategic partners and some of the most influential and important organizations in America today.
Hi, welcome back to Truth and Liberty. I'm Janet Porter, guest hosting today. It is my privilege to have on one of the, I think, most effective, most, how shall I say this? The guy that's made one of the greatest impacts in this country, who won the majority in Congress and actually did something with it. Tom DeLay, he's been called the hammer by the Washington Post. They meant it as an insult. I take it as a compliment. It showed that you actually got things done. And you actually taught me how to lobby, by the way. I don't know if I attribute this to you publicly, but when we were working on passing the heartbeat bill in Ohio, it was your method of whipping the votes that won the day. When I had to get, oh man, well over 20 votes to try and override a veto, I remember working the halls by myself, but I did the Tom DeLay tactic. I had the sheet of the cardstock. I had it folded just like you taught me, Tom, and I had all the members whose votes we needed. We had to pick up, you know, 15, 20 votes that we never got before to get this veto override. That's when I got in the car and went in the drove through the blizzard for 2 hours to bring back our swing vote. Well, it was because the only reason we got that close was because of your whip sheets that I gave to members and said, hey, you see this member in this committee. Can you talk to them? Can you get these two? Can you try these three? And by the end of the day, we actually overrode Governor Kasich's veto in the House. And it was all because I learned from you how to do it. So you did that on the House. You had whip cards for members. They took them out. They checked them off. We then incorporated, as you remember, the wives, the congressional wives, as we spoke to them and got them engaged. I remember talking with one of the congressional wives who said, I said, hey, you know what? Your husband's not on the heartbeat bill. And I remember her response was, oh, he will be. we had a lot of fun, and I sure learned a lot from you. Any special memories jump out at you while we got some calls they're processing right now?
Well, I invented how to whip the vote. I called it grow the vote. And and it was more than just putting a bill on the floor of the House or anywhere else and forcing members to vote for it. What it was I would, before we even introduced, first of all, we had an agenda, like the contract with America. We had an agenda. We had to write bills to accomplish that agenda. So what we did was, before the bills were written, I would use I had a whip team of different members, and I would see where the members were, what they wanted to do, how they wanted to do it. And then I organized around that. Then we introduced the bills. It wasn't a top-down operation. But I also, they still don't do it this way. I knew these members better than they knew themselves. I knew their district. I knew their families. I knew more than just their wives. I knew who they were. They couldn't come up to me and say, I can't vote for that because it's against my philosophy. I say, your philosophy is da 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 da. No, I don't think or they vote, I can't vote for this bill because it's against my district. Wait a minute. Your district is da 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 da. And I would answer all their no's. And there was a lot more work. But by the time we got to the floor, members wanted to vote for it because I took care of their needs. I took care of their wants as far as amendments and things. I took care of them and listened to them and fashioned our strategy based upon that.
I remember you telling me, I knew where they stood on the floor. They're creatures of habit. They'd go to the same corner and talk to their friends. And you knew you worked it. You worked it. And I'll just say, everyone recognized just how good you were at it. And I one of my favorite memories working the Hill with you was we were walking down the hall and we're lugging the papers and we're making the presentation meeting after meeting after meeting. And you drilled one thing into me. said 218. That's the number. That is your number. You get 218, we win. And I was walking down the hall and it dawned on me. I said, hey, Tom, we're going to get to, I think we're going to get to 218. Do you remember what you said?
No, I don't.
You said, why do you think I'm here? Finally, I just felt like finally somebody doesn't think I'm crazy for this idea. And it just was so refreshing. I don't know how to explain to you, but my heart leapt that the guy who's known for getting it done is telling me with assurance that it can be done and it still can be done. So it was one of the highlights for me was hearing from you, not you're crazy or not, you know, look at you, roll your eyes and, you know, go get them, Janet, pat on your head. Because I remember I'd tell most members, I said, you know what? We're going to end abortion. You know, a lot of them were just sort of like, oh, that's nice. You're optimistic, little Pollyanna. But then people started getting it. They caught on. Yes.
Pat you on the head.
Oh, yeah, that's what they did. 719-619-2341. Let's go to Kathleen calling from Virginia. Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for being patient.
Thank you, Janet. Representative DeLay, I just want to thank you for your service and let you know that you were my congressman back when I was growing up in Houston, and we went and pro-life lobbied in D.C., and you were one of the people we saw, also Phil Graham and some other people there, and it just really meant a lot to us, all that you've been doing over the years. And I just was wondering what your thoughts are with this current issue we have with the abortion pills and trying to push those into neighborhood pharmacies, what the best strategy is to combat that?
Well, first of all, most people don't even know there is such a thing as the abortion pill. So we've got a lot to do to educate people about this, and not just that we're against the bill. It's anti-woman. What the side effects from this is very dangerous, and so we need to build a consensus around and educate people and get out, particularly the churches, because we're out to protect women and protect that baby, and the worst thing we can do is that pill. And the other thing too that I'm trying to do now is to, as we talked about earlier, we have to take on the judiciary. We can't. There's no reason whatsoever that the Supreme Court should be hearing this case. We should be going after the FDA and stop using the government agencies that are there, that I wish they weren't there, but they are there, and rally people to oppose the manufacture of these pills and certainly the distribution, while at the same time we have a great opportunity between now and election day to not only educate people, but to communicate with people that we are against this pill, and we're going to do everything we can to stop it, and we're going to elect people that are against it and unelect people that are for it.
You know, one other thing, Kathleen, we might want to consider, I think we can exercise what Don Wildman taught us from the American Family Association, a great leader who recently passed away. He implemented the boycott, and maybe CVS needs to step up that boycott against them or any other drug store that would give out this chemical warfare on the unborn. Also, within the heartbeat bills, many of them have a requirement. In fact, all of them, I believe, have a requirement that you have to test for the heartbeat. All right. You cannot perform an abortion without first testing for the heartbeat. Where, guess what? If you're mailing out this abortifacients through the mail, that is a violation of Texas law, of all these other laws that requires you've got to be there to give a test and let women know that there is a heartbeat. Let her know, that if there is a heartbeat, that child is protected by law. That's a minimum, by the way. That's the floor. Our goal is obviously protecting from fertilization, but heartbeat's a minimum. But that has a provision in there that guards against it. Now, I was there at the Supreme Court last week when they heard the case. And it was a circus. I'm just going to tell you what, the crazies were out like you would not believe. I was this grandmother holding the sign saying, I'm a mother, I need an abortion pill. And I'm like, oh my goodness, this is just crazy. What they would do, the extent that they were screaming and shouting and ranting and raving and the rainbow flags and the trans, and the everybody, all of the left came out and all of it was to engage in chemical warfare against unborn children and to harm women. One of the amicus briefs, by the way, if you want any of this information, you can get on the mailing list at f2a.org. I think it's the first time I've ever plugged my website. But if you go to Faith to Action or F, the number two, the letter A.org, sign up to get the latest. But here's an email that I sent out today talking about, and last week, some of the information about what happened at the court. In the amicus briefs that were filed by the American Center for Law and Justice, one of the issues was the FDA breached its normal protocols for drug approval. They did not require the double-blind trials. They basically put women at risk. And they said, oh, during COVID, you don't have to see a doctor. You're supposed to. But the FDA said you're supposed to, but they waived that. So now they're mailing this stuff through the mail. And I think it's as high as 25% of women are ending up in emergency rooms because they have this assault against them as well. It's appalling what's happening. And I'll tell you one of the signs. Oh boy, I'm just trying to say, here it is. No one, let me blow it up. No one deserves to be chemically starved, poisoned, or dismembered. That was one of the signs at the court. I thought that was a very accurate message. Kathleen, do you have anything else you wanted to say before we let you go?
Yes, thank you both. I'm from Texas, but I live in Virginia, but it's good for people in states with the heartbeat bills in place to know about that. My biggest question is, how do we go after bureaucratic agencies like the FDA who are not doing what they're mandated to do?
Well, I think that starts with the person who puts those people in place. Is that the president, Tom, that shows the importance of this upcoming election, does it not?
Yep. And the Congress needs to exercise its prerogative of the power of the purse. That's how you influence these agencies, is to cut their funding. For whatever reason, if you have a reason to cut the funding like this, this is a perfect. The FDA has not done their job, and they ought to be dragged up before a committee in the House of Representatives, and the House should cut their funding. That gets their attention. I remember one time the FAA wouldn't buy my Sugarland Airport. And I was on the Appropriations Committee, so I cut the funding to their administration. And within a day, I got the funding for the airport.
That's what it takes. It just doesn't seem that there's that courage, that boldness to say, yeah, oh, yeah, bring it. You know what? You want to play? We'll play. So, you know, you want to issue these unconstitutional rulings? We're going to yank your funding. If you want to meet, go meet in Guam. That's what Tom DeLay told the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And that passed. It passed through the House of Representatives. It seems like there always is the problem with the Senate, though. How do you bypass this trumped up 60 vote rule, which they waive, it seems, whenever they want to get something through? But they tell us, well, we've got to have 60 votes to get a heartbeat bill through. What's your answer there, Tom?
I did it. Part of growing the vote was that I wanted to have a start and have an agenda. We had an agenda, Contract with America. After we accomplished 73% of that became law, we needed the next year an agenda. Well, unfortunately, leadership of the Republicans didn't want to have an agenda because it painted a target on your back, a political target. I said, well, we're having an agenda, whether you like it or not. And I worked with the members and put together another agenda, and we were rolling, and we reformed welfare, we balanced the budget, we cut spending, we were rolling. And then I got the idea, well, if we're going to do an agenda as the House, maybe we could bring the Senate in. And the Senate didn't want to even talk to us, but I started doing the press. The fact that the Senate won't meet with the House. And so we had a retreat for the leadership in the House and the Senate. Then we had a retreat with the House members and the senators to develop an agenda that we would carry out in the upcoming year. Well, and everybody had input to that. Everybody, I like this. I don't like this. I want to amend this. I don't want to amend this. And we walked out of there. And then after a year or so of doing that, George W. Bush was president. I forced him to come to our retreats. And so all three of us, the House, the Senate, and the presidency, he didn't come, but his Karl Rove did. And we'd hash it out in some resort somewhere, and we'd hash it out, and we'd walk out of there all agreeable to the agenda. And then all we had to do was implement it, execute it. And that's how you get the Senate.
So tell me this. I just felt frustrated because why have we not had another contract? That's why have we not had another agenda of what we really want instead of I mean, I listened to some of these people on the Hill last week, and they're telling me, well, we've got a few crumbs from the budget. In other words, we're moving toward the cliff a little more slowly. We need to turn this thing around, shift this whole operation to the right direction, because our country's burning down. I think there's a lot of people who are frustrated. They feel hopeless. They feel like there is a one-way road of justice that they're using and weaponizing the government against people like President Trump, Mike Lindell, when they started with you back in 1996. We've got to stand up and we've got to fight back. And I thought this was my thought. I'm just going to pitch it to you. But if the leaders on the Hill won't lead, then let's get the leaders that aren't on the Hill to lead. And so I've asked for a meeting with some of the leaders who are well known, who are those who have been involved in the grassroots for many, many years. And what if we presented the America First Contract, which is, by the way, at theamericafirstcontract.com, that lists the 10 things that we most want: the fight for life, the fight for liberty, to defund abortion. I mean, really? We've got a Republican Congress and we couldn't even defund abortion? What in the world? And that's why I think people they're disheartened. They run for office, they make pro-life promises, they use babies to get elected instead of using elections to save babies. And if we had a contract, and if we said, it's not here handy, but if we said, hey, this is what we believe, this is what we want to do, I believe that people would come out in droves. If there was someone willing to lead, people would follow in droves. That's my opinion, even if the leadership came from outside the Hill. What's your take on it?
Well, far be it from me, Janet, to advise you on how to pass the bill. You're one of the best in the world.
No, I come to you for advice. That's how we got as far as we did.
One little bitty thing that I thought about when you were describing what you're trying to do is defunding abortion. Do you realize that you have to you don't have to put funding for abortion in a bill, and you don't have to, you just don't do it, and it goes away. So all you have to do is get the members an appropriations committee or budget or whatever to just don't fund it. Now, the president could very well veto the bill, and that's fine. Shut her down. We're not going to send the bill with any abortion in there. You want a bill? No abortion. And the other thing, too, is that people don't realize that when we were in the first shutdown, and we lost it because of Bob Dole. The point is that after it's all over, you win, because people look at it and say, oh, you win politically. People say right now, oh, we can't do abortion. Look at all those races we lost because abortion was the issue in Ohio or wherever. We can't do that. Yes, you can. Yes, you can. You can do it. Because what happens is, every time, how hard it was for you to pass the first heartbeat bill, how hard it was. But afterwards, you were victorious politically, because people started coming to you and say, boy, she can do that. I want that in my state. And more people, you grow and grow and grow. And it can be done. If you lay out a strategy and lay out, for instance, going into this next campaign, we have got to develop a communication plan. You are the best communicator on abortion of anybody that I know. And what we got to do is you got to write a plan. You got to write a plan that includes the message, because you're almost right there on the message. What was you saying last week, or at the Trust and Liberty conference? I watched your speech. I can't remember. You only said it once, so I didn't remember. But anyway, the message that you're doing against the constitutional amendment in Ohio. But the point is that. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that what it is that they're all saying all these ballot initiatives are losing. Well, they're actually unconstitutional. We have a guarantee clause in the United States Constitution that says that we have a Republican form of government. You remember the pledge. Everybody who's listening, to the Republic for which I stand. We don't have a direct democracy where it's the mob with the most money runs the show, makes the law. No, that's two wolves and a lamb voting for what to have for lunch. And that's what's happened. It happened in Ohio. Foreign billionaires. We're pouring in millions and millions of dollars into the state, telling everybody it was about fertility care and it was about miscarriage and women and rape and incest. They can. I mean, I could if I was a millionaire, I would just buy ads to end abortion, tell everybody it's about puppies. And you know what? It's about puppies. We love puppies. Isn't that great? And we could pass whatever law we want. But the way it is now is you talk about the foreign influence in the Supreme Court. We've got foreign money coming in to the states, deciding Ohio and Michigan and Arkansas and Florida laws. And that shouldn't be. That's not. It's unconstitutional. And that's why we're going to address this in the courts. But it is it's giving this false signal that this is somehow a losing issue. It is not. But when you have more blood money than we can counter in the pro-life movement, you know what? And they're lying with it to people who are not informed. I mean, unlike the legislative process where we have weeks and months of hearings and debates and everyone is vetted and all the testimony is heard from every side, that's not what the voters are getting. They're getting a message from the people from the mob with the most money, and that's not how a bill becomes a law. So that's the first thing, is that the image they have is that abortion has become a losing issue is not true. And so we've got to make that message heard. But I think one of the things you said is you got to be willing to be the one to stand up and say, you know what, even if they call me crazy. Back when everybody said this can't be done, I went on a radio show and Jason Raper, it was actually one of the Duggar children, heard me on the radio, called up Jason Raper, a senator in Arkansas, and said, hey, there's a thing called a heartbeat bill they're doing in Ohio. What do you think about introducing a bill like that? And they, as you know, in 2013 passed the first one. North Dakota passed it again after that. And it became a thing that 30 states have introduced it. And so I'm not saying it's the answer to everything, but I am saying it's the minimum that we can now do in a post-Roe world. Sorry, Tom, I went a little longer than I wanted.
No, you're absolutely right. And I just want to say that, but we're at a situation right now where it's more comfortable for Republican pro-lifer elected officials to tell Janet Porter, look, you know, that's a bad political issue. I'll lose my district. All you have to do is target the members, particularly the members of the U.S. House of Representatives, and target those senators that are up. So you're not after 435 or 535 elected officials. You got a small universe there that you have to protect. Hopefully you do it in such a way that Trump will want to be in front of that parade that you create. And that is, we have to do their work for them. We have to write a communications plan. We have to take over social media. We have to develop a message that, in the big terms, the message that's a baby. It's not a fetus. That's a baby. And we got to start talking about that's a baby. Yes, we want to protect women, and we want to be sensitive to mothers that find themselves in an uncomfortable position. But at the same time, we are protecting a baby take it from. And there's a lot of other things that we could talk about. We need a national spokesman in the worst way. Somebody like Huckabee.
Well, I'm going to be talking with him. Say again?
You should be a national spokesman.
Well, I see you as one as well, but there's people, as you say, Governor Huckabee, people like Dr. James Dobson, people like Andrew Womack. Here's the vision. What if we had the America First contract and a big poster in the back, and in the back of a wall, and you have members and leaders coming forward and saying, I'm going to sign this, so that there's something written, something guaranteed, so that all those people who've been sitting on the bench saying, why should I vote? People are cheating anyway. They're not going to do what they say anyway. No. If we've got paper, you said something very, very important in this program, that 73% of the contract with America actually got implemented, actually got done. So maybe we should follow Habakkuk 2 to write down the vision and make it plain, so that we can actually have a plan and do the plan. And if the members, like, just say they sign the America First agenda, you've got President Trump on one side, you've got Speaker Johnson on the other, they've got their cameras, that becomes their commercials as they go into the election cycle. And they then are accountable to the voters that they will follow through on these 10 things that we most want. That's what I see. Anything you'd give me input to kind of change that or fix that?
You said something about them doing commercials. You're so good at this. Excuse me. We need to do the commercials for them, not with a lot of money, but just come up with a commercial that says the message that can get through to the people and motivate them. But the members that are running for election can take it and actually use it in their campaign.
Yes.
You don't have to put big, fancy, expensive commercial, just the idea and the message and how you can reach people. Because I watched that organization, pro-life organization of college students. What's her name? I forget her name. Runs that.
Kristen Hawkins.
Kristen Hawkins. I have never seen anybody appeal to another person on behalf of saving a baby than she does, or gets people one-on-one show what an abortion is. Republicans, oh, that's ugly. Oh, I don't want to talk about that. Well, we need to talk about it.
And we need to see what it is. I'm not opposed to showing what an abortion is. That's why I got in the movement. I saw the result of an abortion was a dead baby. That's what it is. And what's happening, I'm afraid, is that the pro-aborts let me just say this one thing, is that Kamala Harris and Biden, the only thing they have to run on, it's not the borders, not the economy, is dead babies. That's all they've got. And if Republicans cower in fear and we don't respond, and if we don't say live baby good to their, their dead baby good, we've got to make the case for life or we'll lose the day. I'll let you finish the final word.
The time we have left, I want you to explain the time when you let the baby testify before the House, and then the baby was shown to the Senate when they testified.
Sure.
You remember
well,
that?
We actually, in the Ohio House, we brought in the youngest to ever testify, and we told this to many members on the Hill. We brought in the youngest to ever testify, a 9-week-old baby Haley. Mother had already named her. And the Senate, by the time we got to the Senate, they said, no, we're not going to let you do your dog and pony show. You can't have the mobile ultrasound. And I said, that's all right. You guys allow video testimony, right? So we played the video testimony in the Senate of little baby Haley, who 9 months later was 6 weeks old. And at that moment, the testimony was the House heard her heart, but the Senate sees her face. And in came walking a senator holding baby Haley in his arms. That was the picture in the paper. That was the moment where people understood what this was. The youngest to testify, who testified in the womb, is now born. And we saw it in Congress, in the Judiciary Subcommittee, where we brought in the youngest baby Lincoln to testify there. And one of the, as that baby was, you see the heartbeat on the screen, the room was silent. And one of the women who had been disrupted, one of the protesters who was very obnoxious and disruptive moments before, was seen wiping tears from her eyes. And that's when I realized that this baby's heartbeat can reach even the hardest of hearts. it can reach America. And that's what he's done and what it's done. And I just want to say my heartfelt gratitude to you, Tom, for giving up hours and hours. And I just want to say you wouldn't take a dime from anybody. You came, you did it sacrificially. That's the only reason why they're talking about a federal heartbeat bill in Congress, because of your leadership, because of your sacrifice, because of your know-how, your experience and your wisdom. And I cannot thank you enough. So any final word? We've got 30 seconds left. I want to give it to you.
You just described the creativity that needs to be into this campaign with the people, the pro-lifers that are running for office, and be on the offense to save those babies. What you're doing, I mean, that alone, that story alone ought to be in a commercial. But anyway, thank you for having me, and God bless you and everything that you do. I just love watching you at work.
God bless you. It's mutual. And the message to Congress, shut her down. Thanks so much. We'll see you next time. God bless you.
Thank you for joining today's Truth and Liberty livecast. You can watch today's and past livecasts in our archives at truthandliberty.net. Our goal is to educate Christians and connect them with resources and organizations to help them impact their sphere of influence. You can help us accomplish this by making a donation at truthandliberty.net/donate. Join us next time for more Truth and Liberty.